Members, I'd like to call the redistricting committee to order today, and I think we're going to start off by approving the minutes. Hopefully you all got a chance to review those in your folder. They are for the January 11th meeting, and Representative Poppe, would you be willing to move those minutes?
I would move those minutes.
Representative Poppe moves the minutes from January 11th, 2011. Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
All right, with a resounding aye, we are going to approve the minutes for January 11, 2011. Members, today what we're going to be doing is we have Tom Glaspy for the state demographer. He's going to speak to us a little bit about timing issues for census data and so forth. And then after that, we're going to have Matt Gehring from our House Research Department give us a historical perspective of the redistricting process for the state of Minnesota. So if we could, if Mr. Glaspy, if you could state your name for the record and your title as well, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Glaspy. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Department of Administration. We recently received results, or at least the first results, from the 2010 census. They were pretty good because we kept our 8 congressional seats, and that is that was something that we were very concerned with, and we managed to keep our 8 congressional seats. Minnesota during the last decade added nearly 350,000 people for a growth rate of 7.8%. That's a little bit slower than the national growth rate, but Minnesota and South Dakota almost tied. We were very close in growth rates for the fastest growth rate among the Frost Belt states, among the states in the northeast and midwest portions of the United States. Minnesota and South Dakota continue to lead that area, as we have done so for over half a century. We rank 26th in total percent change and 21st among states in numeric change. Though not nearly as fast as states like Nevada, growing at 35%, or Texas adding over 4 million people. Most of the growth in the United States occurred in the southwest and southeast portions of the United States, and it is those areas that had the largest gains in the reapportionment. Just looking at an estimated percent change map for counties in the United States, there is a large swath of counties through the whole central part of the United States that have experienced substantial and long-term population decline. Minnesota has some of those counties, especially in the south, southern and southwestern, western portions of the state, and that area continues on down through the entire center of the United States. And that is a pattern that has been in place for about a half a century. Within Minnesota, the most of the growth occurred in the area around the Twin City metropolitan area, from approximately the St. Cloud area down to Rochester, through the Twin Cities, with extremely rapid growth in suburban communities. Minnesota had some of the fastest growing counties in the nation, including the counties of Scott and Carver, Wright and Sherburn, and Isanti and Chisago counties, growing very, very rapidly, while many rural counties and central city areas did not grow so rapidly. In terms of total congressional apportionment, Minnesota's history is we reached a high water mark in 1920 with 10 congressional seats. We dropped down to nine seats in 1930 and to 8 seats in 1960, and we have held 8 seats since then. Our neighboring states have not fared so well. Iowa lost a seat this time. Wisconsin lost a seat 10 years ago. Missouri lost a seat this time, as did Illinois. Ohio lost 2 seats. Michigan lost a seat. Much of the Midwest has seen a continuous deterioration in congressional representation over a long period of time, with the southern and southwestern portions of the country picking up the largest gains. This time, Texas picked up 4 seats, and Florida gained 2 seats. The final apportionment tallies indicated that, yes, indeed, it was very close. Minnesota received the last seat apportioned in Congress. We received it not by a huge margin, but we did receive it. And having beaten out North Carolina, Missouri, New York, New Jersey, and Montana for that last seat. Most of the rest of what I'll talk about, it has to do with the timing of the data and what has happened, we believe, to population concern relative to congressional and legislative seats in Minnesota. First, just looking at congressional seats, it appears right now, based upon estimates that we did in 2009, that two seats, the second and the sixth congressional districts, are substantially larger than the equal population size. The seventh, fifth, fourth, and first seats are substantially below the ideal the equal population size. And that will result in, if the same configuration is maintained, a substantial shift in population from those two large seats of the second and the sixth, which are the suburban seats, into the central city and outstate seats. If we look at legislative districts around the state, the darker shaded areas on this map indicate those that are substantially below, more than 9% below the equal population size, and those are concentrated in southwestern and western and northwestern and northeastern Minnesota. The yellow colored seats are the ones that districts are the ones that are roughly of equal population size, being within plus or minus 2% of the equal population size, and then the darker green seats are the districts that are substantially larger. As you can see, that they are concentrated mostly to the western portion of the Twin Cities, running from the Wright and Sherburne area down to the Scott County area, areas that had experienced very rapid population growth. Within the Twin Cities, there is a cluster of districts at the core of the cities that are also substantially smaller than the equal population size, indicating that if we keep a similar configuration, these will need to be expanded in size, and they are surrounded by districts that have grown quite a bit or are greater than the equal population size.
Mr. Gillespie, yes. If we can just pause a moment here. Those maps were in your materials that you received today, but I believe that you can review those all online, correct?
Those are online, Madam Chair. Those are online. The congressional district map is also here. It's probably hard to see for some, but the maps can be viewed both for Senate seats and for Senate districts and for Minnesota House districts. Relative to that, these are based on estimates that we prepared last year, based upon population as of the middle of 2009. Done a similar kind of estimation in the two previous decades, and they were fairly instructive as to the relative degree of population change over time. As my final slide has to do with what we will receive and when we will receive it, we have already received that total population and apportionment number. We have to receive that before the end of 2010, which we did. By March, probably in late or mid-February, we don't have an exact timing yet. We probably won't know for a week or two, perhaps 2 weeks, but probably more likely 1 week before the data becomes available when the Census Bureau sends us the data for redistricting. This is called the PL94-171 data. It's based upon a federal law that was passed in the mid 70s, and has to do with the relationship between states and the Census Bureau in the delivery and receipt of and structure of data for redistricting purposes. The data will include population totals for all counties, cities, townships, unorganized territories. It will also include population totals for precincts, election precincts. In addition to that, the census geography of tracts, block groups, and blocks will be presented. The data that will be available will include the total population and the population by race and ethnicity, and the population over and under 18. That is not a lot of detail on the population characteristics, but it's mainly a total population database. Population of congressional districts as well as legislative districts will also be indicated on the database, and that database will become available certainly no later than the end of March, but most likely in mid to late February of this year. My understanding is that based upon current law, that the redistricting must be done 25 weeks before the primary in the year ending in 2, which would indicate backing dates up a deadline for completion of work on by February 21st of 2012. Local governments will, the legislature will do the redistricting for congressional districts and for both Senate and House districts within the state. Local governments that have proportional representation will then do their own redistricting after the legislature has finished its task, and there is a prescribed deadlines for their completion so that candidates can file for office and establish residency and run before the primary in 2012.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. And it's your belief that we'll get it possibly by mid-February because of the fact that we have that deadline in place of the February 21st, 2012?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did instruct the Census Bureau that our timing is now shorter than it has been in the past, and that we are quite concerned, and they do their best to send the data out first to the states with the most pressing deadlines. Some states have slightly more pressing deadlines apparently than Minnesota, but we have argued that we should get that earlier, and do hope to have that by mid-February.
Okay, thank you, members. Any questions at all? Great. Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. Members, for those of you that weren't present earlier, we're going to have Matt Gehring, who is our nonpartisan House research staff on this committee. He is going to give us a historical perspective on redistricting. In your packet is his PowerPoint presentation, so you can follow along there. And hopefully technology will be on our side today. And then for members of the public that are watching us today or in the audience today, the presentations will be posted on our website as well if you want to review those once you get back home. Or for folks that are watching on TV, you can review those online once you have a chance. And whenever you're ready, Mr. Gehring. Thank you.
Madam Chair, apologies for technological problems.
I feel your pain.
Madam Chair, apologies for the delay. First part of my presentation is about redistricting from the early 20th century when they did it by paper and pencil, and maybe that's the better way to do it. So I think you should all have a copy of the PowerPoint slides in your packet, so if you want to follow along that way, our page will work on getting the slides up on the screen as we go along. So basically the idea of this presentation today is to give you some context and background for how redistricting has worked in Minnesota in the past. Minnesota has a pretty storied history in terms of process and expectations for how new boundaries are drawn. And so I've gone back basically to 1913, so about 100 years, and have walked through sort of each decade's process, both in the litigation side and the committee process side. The one thing you'll notice, though, just to alleviate your concerns, there are a lot of PowerPoint slides there.
Mr. Gehring, we just lost mics, and that's going to impact our taping. But now we're back, it sounds like.
Yeah. Thought maybe if I rebooted. Everyone's on.
Okay. Go ahead.
So if PowerPoint gets up, you'll see that there's lots of PowerPoint slides. I had planned to burn through them fairly quickly, so don't expect me to keep you here all night or anything, but we'll go through quick. So like I said, what I'm going to do is sort of go through decade by decade. Every decade in Minnesota has been different, which is why I'm separating them out that way. As we go get closer and closer to present day, I'll focus more on the litigation process and the committee process and the challenges that were experienced by the House and Senate committees at the time. With some of the earlier history, I'll just point you to some maps that are in the slides and some numbers that you can see, just sort of background and interest. So in 1913, the legislature decided to increase the size of the legislature. The Senate went from 63 members to 67 members, and from 119 representatives to 130. At the time the size was increased, the legislature also enacted a plan to draw new boundaries for those new members. And for a long time, the district boundaries from 1913 remained in place in Minnesota. There was no legislative redistricting in Minnesota from 1913 until 1959. So people voting in the 1950s were voting in districts that were based on 1913 population counts. In 1933, the legislature did enact a new redistricting.
Mr. Gehring, if I could interrupt a moment. Representative Murphy, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gehring, was there a reason? Do you know what the reason was why they increased the size of the legislature?
Madam Chair, I guess I don't know specifically the reason for the 1913 increase. I know, during that period of time, the state was still growing, and there's concern that there weren't enough representatives in the legislature to effectively represent the people of Minnesota. The time period was different, just in terms of the growth of the country and the growth of the state. And so I think the legislature, it's a statutory size, so the legislature can increase or decrease the size whenever they want to. And in 1913, they chose to increase it for whatever reason.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Mr. Gehring, proceed.
Madam Chair, in 1933, a new congressional districting plan was enacted. This was a result of some 1930s census results, which resulted in the loss of the 10th congressional district in Minnesota. So in 1930, that's kind of the plateau in terms of Minnesota's congressional delegation. We kind of moved from steadily increasing our delegation to sort of the anxiety every 10 years of whether we're going to lose a seat or not. In 1930 was the first year that we lost a congressional seat, and we went from 10 down to 9. The next two slides that you can see in the handout are just some maps just for your reference that show the legislative district boundaries in 1913 and then the congressional district boundaries in 1933. And these aren't specifically going to be relevant to what you're going to be doing, you know, over the next couple of years, but I just thought they were helpful just for some context. And you can kind of see how the districts have shifted and evolved as the population has shifted over time. So in the 1950s and 1960s, people started to realize that the population of the districts, both the legislature and Congress, were pretty out of whack from what was determined to be the actual population based on census data. And in 1958, a suit was filed in federal court by a group of citizens basically alleging that the legislative boundaries for Minnesota were so out of proportion that they violated the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which basically requires equal protection of the laws. And as a factual matter, they're basically correct in their allegation. The range of populations in House districts based on 1950 census data include a small district of 7,290 people and a large district of 107,246 people. So proportionally, in the smallest district, one voter had the same voting power as 14.7 voters in the largest district in the state. The court in this decision in 1958, though, decided they basically agreed with the plaintiff's complaint that the districts were out of proportion, but they decided they were going to defer to the legislature to actually adopt a new redistricting plan. And this is a holding that's been fairly consistent, and you'll see as this theme as we go through that the courts are generally reluctant to impose new districting plans based on their drawing them unless the legislature has had a sufficient opportunity to create one themselves. And so in 1958, the court deferred and said, you know, we're not going to draw a redistricting plan, we're going to defer to the legislature and see how they do.
Okay. Thank you. We're right back in business. All right, very good. If you want to get yourself jumped ahead to your slide that you're on currently.
There we go, Madam Chair. So now all the public can see the court's deferral to the legislature to draw new district boundaries in 1958. So the legislature in 1959 took the court's hint, and they adopted a new legislative plan. Their plan was based, and this is a quote from some language from the time, somewhat using 1950 population data. So it's not quite clear what data they use, and it's so old that I wasn't able to dig it up and actually see the population numbers for the districts that they created, but it was somewhat using 1950 data. And I would also point out that it was enacted during a period of divided government. There's a DFL governor, a DFL House, and a conservative Republican Senate at the time. 2 years later, in 1961, the legislature enacted a new congressional plan as well. And again, this was enacted during a period of divided government. At the, in 1961, we had shifted to a Republican governor and a liberal or DFL House and a conservative and Republican Senate. And so up on the slides here, you can see just the map showing the congressional district boundaries that were enacted in 1961 and the 1959 legislative boundaries. In 1964, the legislative plan that had been adopted in 59 was challenged in federal court as, again, violating the equal protection requirement of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And again, this is basically a correct allegation that based on 1960 census data, the population ranges in legislative house districts range from about 8,300 people to 56,000 people, and the ideal population of a district at the time should have been about 25,000 people. So the plan that had been enacted based on data that was about 14 years old was challenged in court, and the court again declared that the existing plan was unconstitutional, but they decided they would defer to the legislature to try again. And you can see here two quotes basically deferring and granting authority, or not granting, but recognizing the authority of the legislature to be the primary voice and the primary determiner of what should be or how the district should be drawn for the state. So in 1965, after the districts had been declared unconstitutional, the legislature again passed the plan. This time it was vetoed by Governor Rollbog. In 1966, another plan in an extra session was passed, again vetoed. And on the third try, the Republican legislature and DFL governor agreed on a plan. And so May 20th, 1966, there were some new boundaries that were enacted for Minnesota. And those boundaries were in effect through the 1970s. After the 1970 census, of course, there's a new redistricting process began again. In the 1970s, you again have divided government between the Republican legislature and a DFL governor. The congressional plan in the 70s was the very easy process. It's probably the easiest one of all of the plans that have been enacted over the course of Minnesota history. In 1971, a congressional plan was enacted by the legislature. On June 7th, it was signed by the governor, and that was it. And you can see them on the slide here, a map of showing the districts in 1971. The legislative plan, however, in the 70s was a bit more complicated, and it's actually one of the, there are sort of two decades that are quirky in Minnesota redistricting history. The 1970s is one of them, and the 1990s will be another one that I'll talk about in a few minutes. In the 1970s, in a regular session, the legislature approved, the House approved a plan, but the Senate didn't agree to the House's plan. So an extra session was called later in 1971. The House and Senate did agree on a plan together, but it was pocket vetoed by Governor Anderson November 1st of 1971. Also in 1971, in November, a federal court, a challenge had been put against the existing boundaries at the time, and the federal court declared that the existing set of district boundaries were invalid and unconstitutional, and those boundaries were the ones that were enacted in the 1960s. The court at this time set a specific set of criteria to be used in creating new plans, including requiring single-member, compact, and contiguous districts of as equal population as possible, which is actually the requirement that's in the Minnesota Constitution. The criteria also included an allowance for population deviations of up to 2% above or below the ideal population if it's necessary to preserve political subdivision boundaries. So if you're looking at drawing a line that's going to cut through a city or a county or some other type of subdivision, population deviation is acceptable for that reason, but for no other reason. The court also said that there could be no consideration of incumbent residences or political voting patterns in creating a new plan in the 1970s. In December of 1971, based using this new criteria, the court was actively working to figure out what boundaries would be acceptable and what would be constitutional, and the court decided that the best way to enact a constitutional legislative plan was to actually reduce the size of the legislature entirely. And so their plan, or their order, included language that would reduce the size of the Senate to 35 Senate districts, and there would be 105 House districts. So basically, within each Senate district, you'd have three House members in sort of an A, B, and C district within Senate districts. As you might expect, the Senate wasn't happy with the reduction in their membership to 35 members, and they appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. While the appeal was pending, in January of 72, the federal court did issue a new plan with new district boundaries that included this reduction in the size of the legislature. So for a while, it appeared that there could be this reduction to 35 senators and 105 House members, until April of 1972, when the Minnesota Senate's appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court succeeded, and the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the federal court to basically create a new plan and required them to adhere as closely as possible to the statutory size of the legislature as enacted by the Minnesota legislature. So In other words, there's some deviation to the size that they could, you know, that was necessary to make a proper plan, but they couldn't go so far below the existing statutory size as they had previously. So in June of 1972, the federal court issued a revised plan, and this time it included the current 134 House districts with 67 Senate districts, so there are two House members within each Senate district. And here you can see the map showing the legislative boundaries as enacted in 1972 based on the court's order. And there's a map that shows the metro legislative districts as well. In the 1980s, the Minnesota population for the first time cracked 4 million, which is about a 7% increase from the 1970s population. To sort of set the stage here, the congressional plan in May of 1981, the House introduced a plan to create new congressional districts. Let's have some dates backwards there. There are different plans approved by the House and the Senate. The plans went to conference committee, and the House and Senate failed to agree in conference on a new set of congressional boundaries. As far as the legislative plan, in January of 82, the Senate introduced a plan for legislative districts and approved it fairly quickly. It was referred to the House, where it died in committee. In March of 82, the federal court sets a new set of legislative boundaries after a challenge had been issued to the existing boundaries, and they listed a set of priorities to be used in creating those boundaries, including population equality, respecting minor civil division boundaries, compactness and contiguity, also some new language requiring an increasing probability of minority representation where that would be possible, and including metro area residents within districts that are located entirely within the metro area. So they had a specific set of metro boundaries in mind, and they wanted to keep the voters within those boundaries, within districts that were entirely located within the metro area, as opposed to having districts divided between some rural areas and some metro areas. The court also allowed for some minor adjustments for what they called constituency legislator relations. Basically, what I got from the court case, constituency legislator relations is the idea that they wanted to keep members kind of within the same territory as they had been in the past, so that incumbent representatives and senators weren't suddenly representing an entirely new group of people, that they largely had intact the same constituency that they had before. So, as I said, these new boundaries using these priorities were issued by the federal court in 1982, and in 1983 the legislature followed along and adopted the court-ordered plan into law with some sort of minor and technical adjustments.
Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much. So what you're saying is that in 1982 we would have had to have an election before the legislature actually put it into law, where the election was based off the 82 districts before the legislature actually approved it? Or am I misunderstanding that? How did that work?
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt. So the idea here is that the court issued new boundaries in 1982. They'd issued them in March, and so they were the boundaries that were used in the 1982 general election. The legislature decided following the 82 election during the 1983 session that they would enact, you know, they basically took the court's ordered boundaries and enacted them into law, so you aren't just based on a court order, you're actually putting into statute these boundaries. But in doing so, they also made some adjustments. So the legislature still, even with a court order, can enact its own plan, and as long as it's constitutional, that plan is what's going to take priority. And so in 1983, they decided they would take the court order plan, make some changes, and they enacted that into law. So there were some tweaks between the 1982 general election and the 1984 general election.
Representative Marquardt?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Gary?
So the next slide, I just have a map here showing the legislative district boundaries in 1982, in both a statewide and a rural look, or metro look, excuse me. The congressional plan in the 1980s went through the same sort of litigation process. In September of 1981, congressional boundaries were declared invalid. Again, these are the boundaries that had existed previously based on data from the 1970s. In the course of deciding what the new boundary should be, the federal court took into consideration some internally created plans by their own consultants and staff, as well as accepting plans from outside groups, including the plaintiffs in the challenge to the boundaries, which is there were a group of citizens. There's a plan submitted by the Minnesota Senate, and then two plans submitted by the Independent Republican Congressional Delegation, one of which was a revised version of a plan that had been considered here in the House, then an alternate plan as well that I believe had been worked on by the Republican National Committee. The federal court decided they weren't going to adopt any of these submitted plans, but they basically created their own. Among the standards that they used was included recognizing that basically half of the population lives in outstate Minnesota and half of the population lives in the metro area, and so that they were going to design and place congressional districts based on that recognition. They also included another standards recognizing that they needed to advance the Minnesota Constitution's requirement of convenient and contiguous and compact territory, and they also wanted to use consistency in creating congressional boundaries with the principles that were used in the legislative apportionment that they had previously done. The court also specified a little further some additional congressional criteria for redistricting, including specifying that congressional districts must be as nearly equal in population as possible, which for them included a maximum deviation of plus or minus 0.25 of 1%. The required single-member, compact, and contiguous districts, again, consistent with the Minnesota Constitution's requirements and the legislative requirements. They also sought to preserve political subdivisions and to preserve the voting strength of minority populations and increase the probability of minority representation in areas where there's a sizable concentration of a particular minority. The court also said that they would preserve communities of interest wherever that's possible. And here you can see a map from 1982 showing the congressional district boundaries as they were adopted by the court. So those boundaries were in place, again, through the mid-90s, basically. The 1990s process, as I mentioned, is another one of the quirky ones. During the 1991 regular session, there are three sort of pieces of legislation that passed and got the ball rolling. First is that the legislature adopted two concurrent resolutions setting standards for both legislative and congressional redistricting processes. Those resolutions were effective for the 1990s process only, and I'll talk a little bit more about those resolutions and principles for redistricting in a minute. The legislature also adopted in the 1991 regular session a new law approved by the governor, which set the statutory deadline for completing new redistricting plans. This is the 25 weeks prior to the state primary requirement that's currently in 204B14. So prior to that, there had been no statutory deadline for completing the work. And as of 1991, this new 25-week plan was signed into law. And finally, the big piece in 1991 was that the House and Senate approved of a legislative plan. They passed it and sent it to the governor. Since I wasn't around at the time, I won't be able to share all the intrigue that happened over the course of that process. But basically what happened was that the House and Senate approved their plan. It was sent to the governor at the time, and the governor failed to veto it within the constitutionally required time period. And so the plans that were approved by the House and the Senate became law without the governor's signature. And there was a whole bunch of litigation that resulted from these attempted vetoes that eventually came down in favor of the legislature and against the governor's vetoes. After the plan had been approved and went into law, people noticed that there were some technical problems with the drafting of the bill. And so the Senate Minority Leader at the time challenged the legislative plan based on these technical errors. The technical errors basically were problems with the way that districts were described legally in the bill, and they caused the districts to be non-contiguous, non-compact, and created some population problems. And so there were some clear issues with the way the bill was drafted, and there was a challenge to the plan based on those issues. In October of 1991, a state court took a look at that plan and decided the plan had so many technical errors that it indeed was unconstitutional. And the state court at the time announced the plan to draw their own plan, basically correcting the errors and basing their new boundaries off of the legislature's plan unless the legislature could agree on a new plan and enact it into law. A couple of months later, in December, however, a federal court, there had been two challenges to the boundaries, one proceeding in state court and the other proceeding in federal court. The federal court issued an injunction preventing further state court action related to redistricting boundaries. So basically, the federal court at the time said that, you know, we're the authority and we're going to be the ones to decide what the boundaries should look like. After that injunction was issued, the state court still issued their own set of revised and corrected districting plans subject to the federal injunction. So they were respectful of the federal court's order, but still wanted to put their plan out there. So that was issued December 9th, 1991. It wasn't quite clear what the new boundaries would be pending the resolution of the injunction, however. In January of 92, a special session was convened. The legislature at the time approved a plan for both congressional districts and for correcting the prior incorrect legislative plan. Ultimately, both of those plans were vetoed by Governor Carlson in an effective and valid veto, which meant that the state court plan went into effect because during that process, a day before Governor Carlson's veto, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered an injunction, the injunction that the federal court had issued against the state court, to be lifted. So basically that means the U.S. Supreme Court sided with the state court and said the federal court was wrong in sort of claiming authority over redistricting, and they should have allowed the state court to proceed with their districting plans. The federal court continued with their case, and in February of 1992, despite the Supreme Court order, they had a three-judge federal court panel issued both legislative and congressional plans, which they said preempted the state court plans. In March of 1992, this order was appealed again to the U.S. Supreme Court. The state court plan was upheld as it related to the legislative boundaries. The federal court plan was upheld as it related to the congressional boundaries. So you had two courts drawing boundaries for the state court did the legislative districts and the federal court did the congressional districts. At the time, the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledged that they wanted to hear more about this issue, but decided they wouldn't schedule additional hearings until after the 1992 elections had taken place. This appeal happened in March of 1992, and again, you're going up against the deadline for completing plans, and so they decided they would wait until 1993 to hear more testimony and look into this further. So in February of 1993, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously that the federal court had overstepped its authority and should have deferred to both the legislative and state court processes in designing new boundaries, which meant that in 1994, the boundaries that were in place were the state court-ordered boundaries for both legislative and congressional districts. Also in 1994, the legislature basically enacted the court-ordered legislative plan, again with some corrections like there had been in the 1970s. They also adopted the court-ordered congressional plan and enacted that into law. There were additional minor modifications to those plans that followed in 1997 as well. So basically, as I mentioned, the sort of end result of the 1990s process, in 1992 you had legislative boundaries that were as ordered by a three-judge state court panel, and you had congressional boundaries that were as ordered by a three-judge federal court panel. With the ensuing U.S. Supreme Court appeals and litigation, by 1994, you had legislative boundaries that were basically unchanged with some corrections by the legislature, but primarily as ordered by the state court panel, and then the congressional boundaries had reverted to the original order of the state court, and the federal court ordered boundaries were no longer in effect. That brings us to the 2000s. So the 2000s process started fairly early with some litigation. On January 4th of 2001, the first suit was filed in the state court alleging that the current districts, as had been based on the 1990s census data, were unconstitutional based on the new 2000 census data that had just been released a few weeks earlier. In January also of 2001, the plaintiffs from the 1990s case sought to intervene and wanted to have the same three-judge panel that had ordered the district boundaries in the 1990s to also draw the boundaries in the 2000s. That motion went to the Minnesota Supreme Court. In March of that year, they granted the motion but stayed it pending action of the legislature. So they basically said, we agree that the boundaries are malapportioned right now based on the population, and we will agree to appoint a panel of judges to draw boundaries if needed, but we want to wait and see what the legislature does, and ultimately we're deferring to the legislative process to get boundaries implemented first before we're going to order new boundaries. And in March of 2001, there was still plenty of time to do that before the statutory deadline came the next year. In July of 2001, the Minnesota Supreme Court decided they needed to get started, and so they appointed a 5-judge panel rather than a 3-judge panel, as had been the case in the 90s. But again, in appointing their panel members, they pointed out that it's primarily the role of the legislature to do redistricting, and that the panel and the court needed to honor that process and not be drawn prematurely into drawing new district boundaries. In October of 2001, as the case was continuing, the plaintiffs from the 1990s case, as well as a number of other state and federal officials, were granted permission to intervene in the lawsuit, which had been consolidated into this one case that was moving through the court system. So by then, you had 4 different groups of plaintiffs that were suing the state, basically alleging that the boundaries were malapportioned and they all had their own plans. In December of 2001, the 5-judge panel that had been appointed set criteria for the plans, including the statutory requirements related to numbering and nesting of House districts within Senate districts, as well as requiring faithful adherence to the concept of population-based representation. They also required districts to be contiguous and compact, and that no substantial weight could be given to the impact of new boundaries on incumbents or political parties. In January of 2002, just a month after they issued those criteria, the 5-judge panel set out on a tour of the state. They had statewide public hearings to take testimony on plans and to listen to plans that were being submitted by various parties. And on March 19th of 2002, the 5-judge panel issued both new legislative and congressional district boundaries after the legislative process here had failed to come to an agreement. March 19th of 2002 is the statutory deadline for, or at the time it was the statutory deadline for adopting new district boundaries. And so they waited, and when that deadline came and the legislature hadn't enacted a plan, they issued their own plan. The legislative plan, just some statistics are here in the slides for you. Their mean population deviations for both the Senate and the House are fairly small. There's 0.28% for the Senate and 0.32% for the House districts. They divided a fairly small number of political subdivisions, given the total number of subdivisions we have in the state. And they also respected a number of communities of interest, including tribal reservations, geographic interests like the Iron Range, the Red River Valley, and the St. Croix River Valley. They also tried to maintain shared districts in counties that had shared services. They were interested in maintaining Minneapolis and St. Paul organized neighborhood boundaries as a community of interest. And then they also felt that a number of minority groups were represented and reflected in as communities of interest based on the new political boundaries that had been set. The court in the legislative plan did not give consideration to political competitiveness, but they did make some minor adjustments in the interest of avoiding incumbent protection or avoiding conflicts among multiple incumbents in one district. And here you can see a map of the legislative district boundaries. This should look quite familiar to all of you, because these are the boundaries that you're currently operating under. And here's the metro view. The congressional plan that was issued by the court in the 2000s was a plan that was very exact in population equality, which is as it needs to be constitutional. There was zero population deviation. I think there was one district based on this plan that had one fewer person than the ideal population. The rest of the districts that were implemented by the court were exactly at the ideal population number. This is a requirement of the U.S. Constitution that congressional districts must be exactly equal in population. The congressional plan also included, in the words of the court, convenient, contiguous, and compact territory. They engaged in some population shift analysis to determine where the district should be located. So they were kind of looking at where the centers of population were and decided that the urban and suburban area should have 5 districts and greater Minnesota should have 3 districts. They also had some new communities of interest in addition to the ones that I listed. Related to the legislative plan, they decided that the I-90 and I-94 corridors were communities of interest because of the interconnected nature of of those cities and those areas being connected by the interstate. They also protected suburbs as a community of interest. And they took a look at possibly combining Minneapolis and St. Paul into one congressional district, but decided against that based on sort of the history of the way districts had been drawn previously, and decided that Minneapolis and St. Paul were sufficiently different that at the time it wouldn't be appropriate for them to be combined into one. And here's a map of congressional districts in Minnesota. Again, they should look quite familiar because these are the current districts that are in place today. Just a few facts about the litigation process in the 2000s. The entire course of the litigation spanned about 21 months. As I mentioned earlier, there were four groups of plaintiffs that were parties in the action. Each of them filed their own version of a plan and sought to challenge the other plans. These are all public plans that are available on the web. At the time, Zachman is the named plaintiff in the case. That was a group of primarily Republican plaintiffs. Kotlow was the 1990s plaintiffs, who were primarily members of the DFL party. Governor Ventura at the time was an intervening party and was a plaintiff in the case. And then there was a group of DFL legislators and members of Congress that were also a party to the case. There was one group that filed an amicus brief. That was the Minnesota Women's Campaign Fund. In the end, because the court ultimately decided that the boundaries that were in place were unconstitutional, the plaintiffs were determined to be all prevailing parties, which meant that they were entitled to an award of attorney's fees and costs for the litigation. So the very last step of the litigation process was an order that the state and local governments pay $368,000 in attorney's fees and costs to all the plaintiffs together to cover their costs for the litigation. So while the litigation was ongoing, there was still a process in the legislature, here in the House and the Senate. People still were genuinely trying to get a plan passed. The House and the Senate committees were meeting during the 2001 legislative session. They were meeting separately to develop both district plans as well as districting principles. One of the obstacles that the committees met in 2000s was sort of a struggle between the House and the Senate to determine what districting principles should be appropriate for use in designing district boundaries. There were several bills that were kind of going through the process at the time. One was a resolution. The other was an actual bill that would adopt districting boundaries into statute. A conference committee was appointed in May of 2001 on a resolution bill, so it would have been similar to what was enacted in the 1990s. It would have been a resolution between the House and the Senate on standards, which would have applied to the 2000s process only. The conference committee was appointed, didn't come to agreement. And there was a motion to appoint the conference committee again in 2002, but ultimately that didn't really go anywhere. Part of the reason that the principles were so hard to settle were because there were some pretty strong opinions both in the House and in the Senate about what the principles should be. And so the next couple slides here, I just have some comparisons between the House version of the districting principles and the Senate version. In the House plan, a population deviation of plus or minus 0.75% would have been an acceptable deviation. The Senate would have permitted a greater population deviation of plus or minus 2%. There is some differing language related to how minorities should be represented in districts. In the Senate, the resolution said that where possible, districts must increase the probability that members of the minority will be elected. The House language was slightly different than that. You can see the language there on the slide. In the House version of the districting principles as proposed, the only reference to political competitiveness was that the districts must not unduly favor any political party. In the Senate version of the resolution, the Senate would have required that districts be politically competitive where possible, and that also that districts must not be drawn to protect or defeat an incumbent, and that language wasn't included in the House version of the principles. The House version did, however, establish a prioritized list of which principles had to come first and which ones were secondary. The Senate didn't do that. The Senate just included sort of a list of things that had to be taken into consideration in drawing the plans. So ultimately, there was no agreement on those principles, which made it much more difficult to actually agree on a plan, because if you're not agreeing on what the plan is supposed to look like, you can't necessarily negotiate the plan itself. Over the course of the process, however, there were still plans being submitted and considered. Between 2001 and 2002, there were 10 different congressional redistricting plans. that were submitted in both houses of the legislature, and 11 different legislative plans. Ultimately, there was a Senate bill that became a vehicle but failed in conference committee. One of the plans was submitted by Governor Ventura's advisory commission at the time, which didn't become the vehicle, but it was one of the plans that were submitted in the process. As I mentioned, the legislative process basically failed in the 2000s, and the boundaries that were put into place were those that were ordered by the court. The legislature has come back in subsequent years and modified those boundaries somewhat. In both 2003 and 2004, there have been some fairly minor boundary adjustments that affected a couple of House districts. But other than that, the boundaries that are in place currently are basically those that were ordered by the court. And that brings us to the 2000s. Mr. Gillespie has already told you sort of the population numbers and the statistics from the census that you'll be working with as you go forward. And I just have here is my final slide, the timeline, which you all probably know about. But the big one, of course, is February 21st of 2012, which is the statutory deadline for completing both congressional and legislative district boundaries. You might note that this is it's an earlier date than it has been in the past, and that's because of the bill last year that changed the date of the state primary from September to August, shifted the deadline for completing redistricting, so now you have a mid-February deadline as opposed to a mid-March deadline, as has been the case in the last couple of years, couple of decades. And then November 6th of 2012 is the first general election at which whatever new set of boundaries you agree upon must be used. And Madam Chair, that's all I have. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Members, any questions at all? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Gehring, what happens if there is no plan in place by February 21st of 2012? Gehring? Could be agreed upon?
Mr. Gehring?
Madam Chair, if there's no plan in place, I should say, if the legislature hasn't agreed on a plan and the governor hasn't signed a plan by that date, then it's likely that the court will issue a new set of boundaries based on whatever criteria they decide to use in this round of the process, or in this decade of the process. During the 2000s, as I mentioned, the court issued its new set of boundaries exactly on the statutory deadline for completing boundaries. And so I think it's fair to assume that whether the legislative process works or whether it's going to be a process in litigation, on February 21st of 2012, there's going to be a set of boundaries in place, either enacted by the legislature or by the court.
Representative Marco, any other questions? Okay, thank you, members. We are adjourned.